Calling to order the Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Wednesday, November 18th, 2009. Welcome back, everyone. We have two issues on our agenda plus a work group update, and we are going to start today with an informational meeting on Senate Bill 952, which is a bill that actually went through the Senate Judiciary Committee and then to the floor. It deals with what happens to tenants in foreclosure. And we have some invited testimony. Do I need to gavel into an informational meeting?
No, I think you're fine.
Okay.
You might want to say Senator George is excused.
Oh, yes. Senator George is excused today. That's why he's not here. So we're going to start with the first panel on the agenda, and that is Christina Dirks from Legal Aid Services of Oregon, Ed Johnson.
Actually, I'm
subbing you. Okay. Sybil Hebb from Oregon Law Center and John Van Landingham from Lane County Law and Advocacy Center. So if you want to come up and kind of set the stage and then let us know what's on your mind.
Anyone to have bills?
And would any of the committee members like a copy of Senate Bill 952?
Do you have it handy?
Yes, we do.
We do have it handy if you'd like it. So,
would you like it, Sonny?
Welcome. And you can go in any order you would like.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today. I want to first, with my colleagues, Mr. Van Landingham and Ms. Dirks, and I want to first thank you all so much for the work that you did during the session on this issue of protecting tenants in homes that are being foreclosed on, but also for your willingness to continue the discussion. We wanted to take a little bit of time today just to give you a little overview. There is federal law that was passed on this issue, the legislature in Oregon passed state law, so we wanted to give you an overview of how those two laws are interacting, and then also let you know a little bit about some of the issues that we have identified as implementation has begun. We'll give you a summary of all of those issues. You're having a document passed out now that lists them. There's also a summary of the state and federal law in front of you. We've shared our list of issues with industry, and we'll continue to discuss those with them. There are a couple of technical fixes that we hope to make in 2010 that we believe would be non-controversial and are really just to fix drafting errors and clean up a few things. There are some more substantive issues that we believe are important and that we would like to look at in the future. We are still learning about those issues, and so our goal today is to tell you about them and to engage in that, begin that discussion. So John and Christina will flesh some of these issues out for you, and at the end we'll be happy to take any questions. Thank you again.
Thank you, Sybil. John?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Van Landingham, Lane County Law and Advocacy Center. My task is to talk to you about the federal law and the state law that you passed last session, and to talk about what we were calling the technical fixes that we would like to see the special session address. And I'm going to be referring to both of the documents that Sybil gave you. The first one is it two-sided in what they?
Yes.
It's two-sided. The first side is a summary. It says summary of state and federal laws. The federal law was passed in May by Congress. It's entitled the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act of 2009. It is one page long, the entire federal law. So, as you can imagine, there's not a lot of detail there, and that's one of the issues that the industry is dealing with and that we have to think about also, because our law is more comprehensive. The federal law was effective as soon as the president signed it, so that's May 20 of 2009, and what it does is provide that purchasers at a foreclosure sale have to give extra notice to residents who are in the home, what they've defined as bona fide tenants. And we talk some more about that later as an issue. If it's a month-to-month tenancy, the notice has to be at least 90 days long. If it's a fixed-term tenancy, it has to be the full length of the fixed term. So if it's a one-year lease, then the buyer at the foreclosure sale has to wait the full 1 year. And that also applies to Section 8 tenancies, which often, initially at least, Section 8 tenancies are for the first period of a one-year term. It only applies to what the feds call the bona fide tenant. So, and I think the purpose there is to get at making sure that it's not the borrower, the person who forfeited on the loan, that got foreclosed upon. That law has a sunset in it of 2012. That law does not preempt additional state law. So the back page of that two-page handout is what you all passed last session in two different bills, 952 and House Bill 3004. And I've already forgotten why we had to do 3004, but it had something to do with a mistake that we figured out late in the session, and a change that we negotiated with the industry. So instead of requiring 90 days notice, what you passed requires 30 days notice, and or 60 days if it's a fixed-term tenancy of longer than month-to-month. That was significant because under prior law, it was arguable that while a landlord had to give, a buyer or a foreclosure had to give a 30-day notice, they could give the notice before the foreclosure sale. So it's significant under the law you passed that that notice can't be given until the foreclosure sale, until somebody acquires the property at the foreclosure sale from the person who's defaulted on the loan. Month to month, they have to give at least 30 days. If it's a fixed term, they have to give at least 60 days, unless they're buying the property to live in. In that case, it can be 30 days.
And I just wanted to ask, John, if you could explain a little bit about the reason why the difference was to there was a hold on just a second. Do we have a problem?
Yeah, one copy was the same on both sides.
Oh, okay. So. That's a problem. That is a problem. If you could talk a little bit, just to explain why that was a problem when the notice came before the foreclosure went through.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are not foreclosure experts or real estate experts. Christina, hopefully, knows more than Sybil and I do. But in a foreclosure sale, before the sale, you don't know who's going to acquire the property. And as industry asserted to us in our negotiations during the session, there are people, investors, who go and buy these properties. The lender, presumably is foreclosed, and the lender can bid in its debt, anybody else has to pay at the foreclosure sale with cash. But there are investors who are acquiring these properties. So how do we know until the foreclosure sale who it is that's going to be the owner after the foreclosure sale? And in addition, the debtor, the borrower, could redeem the property and avoid the foreclosure up until 5 days before the foreclosure sale. So part of our feeling was how does the tenant know what's really going on here and whether something's going to happen and who it is that has the right to give them an eviction notice? Is that what you were?
Yes, thank you very much.
I mentioned earlier bona fide tenants in the Oregon version of what we passed. Bona fide is the term the feds use. We use the term good faith tenancies. The way we negotiated and wrote it, the good faith is the good faith of the landlord, in other words, the borrower, the person who created this tenancy in the first place. You'll remember, overall, what we're talking about here is a tenant who's apparently doing what the tenant is supposed to do in the tenancy. The landlord, the borrower, is the one who's defaulting and creating this problem. State law requires that the lender, in giving the foreclosure notice, give some warning to the tenant. So some part of the notice has to be addressed to the tenant to say, this is what's going on. Otherwise, the notice could come to the property address to the landlord, the borrower, and if the tenant doesn't open that, they're not going to know what's going on. So there's a notice requirement that is supposed to explain to the tenant what the process is and what their rights are. Because we were writing this at the time that we knew that Congress was thinking about doing something, but we didn't know what Congress was going to do, it does have a reference to the federal law, but it doesn't do a very good job of making it clear what that federal law would be because we didn't know at the time. In addition, the state law says that during that foreclosure notice period, the 120-day period, the tenant has the right to apply any security deposit or prepaid rent against rent that's accruing at the time. The assumption is that the landlord, the borrower, is going to be gone, and we're not going to get that. We're not going to see that money ever again. We negotiated with the industry not to make them responsible for the deposit. They don't want to be responsible for the deposit. That was the deal, that tenants have that right. They have to give written notice to the landlord that they're going to do that. And then we also made it's not on the outline, but we also made a number of provisions in your law about the role of the lender after the foreclosure sale. And we clarified there that the lender does not become a landlord unless the lender accepts rent after the foreclosure sale. That's one of the weaknesses in the federal law. The federal law doesn't define the lender's role after the foreclosure, and impliedly could well be a landlord and have the responsibility of the landlord during that 90-day period or the full term of the fixed term. So those are the two different laws. The issues that I wanted to mention are on the outline of issues that Sybil gave you all. It's a four-page outline, and the first one is just to refer to some of those conflicts. I've already mentioned a couple of them. The federal law, which supersedes, of course, state law, is a 90-day at minimum notice. Ours is 30 or 60. There's a different definition of what tenants qualify as good enough. And then we require notice from the lender, and the feds do not. We also require the tenant to notify the lender if the tenant wants to assert that 30-day notice requirement. The fixes that we're interested in, and I believe that the chair has already indicated to the Legislative Council that these might be something that
that's correct.
Gets pursued. The two of them are not. One way to put it is, two of them are not our fault. One of them is. The two that are not our fault. The first is that the notice provision, which is in the statute, is difficult to understand, at least on the fourth grade level, or otherwise known as the Jim Marquis level. So when Jim Marquis
he's
told
smiling,
us,
I thought I'd tell you that.
When Jim Marquis told us it was too complicated, we knew we had to make it. No. Jim's right. It is hard to understand, and in fact, I think we need to keep working on that when we get it back from LC to make it better. The second issue is that, as I said earlier, in 952 and 3004, we provided that lenders that acquire the property after the foreclosure are not landlords and are not responsible for the deposit. But there is a statute in the Landlord-Tenant Act, 90.300, which says that the entity that acquires a landlord's interest, and it doesn't distinguish in foreclosures, is responsible for the deposits. And that's typically aimed at someone who buys the property, or even a lender that gets a property in a deed in lieu of foreclosure. We need to make that distinction, because otherwise I'm afraid that somebody's going to miss that point, that we didn't expect the lenders to be responsible for the deposits. The fix that is our fault is that we intended this warning notice to tenants to go to residential tenants only. And the way it was written, it applies to all tenants, and there are foreclosures of commercial tenants. And it doesn't make any sense to give them a notice about the rights of residential tenants. The notice itself isn't clear that it's limited to residential tenants. And we're causing, because of our mistake, I think some people doing foreclosures and lawyers are confused and troubled.
There's few things worse than confused and troubled lawyers.
That's it for me.
Thank you, John. Christina?
Hi. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, I'm Christina Dirks from Legal Aid Services of Oregon. Thank you for inviting me here to discuss my observations around the implementation of these new tenant foreclosure statute. As the committee likely knows, Legal Aid Services provides free legal services to low-income Oregonians. My work in the Multnomah County office is as a staff attorney, primarily working in landlord-tenant law. So I am seeing firsthand how this foreclosure crisis is affecting tenants in Multnomah County. And obviously the passage of Senate Bill 952 gave tenants in Oregon a new and much-needed set of rights. And with each call that's coming into our office, we're seeing how these rights are actually being implemented on the ground with tenants who are getting these notices and learning of the foreclosure of their homes. There's a few issues that I've seen come up in the calls we've gotten to our office that I'd like to share with you. The first issue that I find the most compelling is those tenants that move in after the 120-day notice of sale is given, but before the home is foreclosed on. I call these the tenants that move in during the gap. So it's, you know, the gap of time, and our state statute provides that any tenant that defines the good faith tenancy as those that was created voluntarily and in good faith by the landlord. And the statute goes on to define that a good faith tenancy for a fixed term lease is one that was created before the 120-day notice was sent out, and for month-to-month tenancy, it presumes that any month-to-month created after that 120-day notice is sent out is presumed to not be in good faith. So you can overcome that presumption, but, you know, there is this basic assumption that it was not created in good faith. So the good faith definition is linked to the knowledge of the landlord at the time they entered into the rental agreement and whether this notice of sale was sent out or not. It doesn't look to what the tenant knew when they entered into the rental agreement. And I believe this gap in protection leaves out some of the most vulnerable tenants. And I have an example that I think might help illuminate that. I had a client recently who found this great home, a two-bedroom house for her and her husband and her two children. She signed a year-long lease and paid $1,200 to move in as a security deposit. 2 months after she moved in, she got a knock on the door. She went to answer the door, and it was some stranger standing there and said, "Your home has been foreclosed on. I'm the new owner as of yesterday." She had no idea that the home was facing foreclosure the 2 months prior when she signed this lease agreement. And clearly, if she had known, she wouldn't have entered into this rental agreement. And the landlord gave her no indication that the home was facing foreclosure. You know, I can only assume what his intentions were in terms of getting some extra income. And just as a side note of interest, she went to call her bank to stop payment on the rent check she had just made a few days prior when she got this, after she got this knock on the door and found out that the landlord had actually cashed the check that same day, which was the day after he actually lost the home at foreclosure. So she was out a fair amount of money, including her security deposit, and clearly would not have signed this lease agreement if she had known the home was in foreclosure. And under our current law, she wasn't entitled to any protection because she moved in after this 120-day notice of sale went out. I believe her situation really points to the fact that this analysis as to good faith of a tenancy really needs to focus on the tenant's perspective and not the landlord's perspective. You know, unfortunately, landlords have many different incentives to get a tenant into a property that's in foreclosure. You know, they might just want some extra money on the side, or they might legitimately have hopes that, you know, this extra rental income might help them save off the foreclosure and get current on the loan. But, you know, there is an incentive there for landlords to get folks into these residential properties, whereas tenants really, as far as I have seen, have no incentive to move into a home when it's facing foreclosure, assuming it's an arm's-length transaction. You know, there's not some cahoots between the landlord and the tenant. Most tenants just want a place to live that's safe and secure and aren't trying to dupe anybody over. And so, you know, I think these folks are actually the most vulnerable because they don't usually learn about the foreclosure until it's too late, till the foreclosure has happened. You know, their old landlord is who knows where, not responding to phone calls, and they're being told they need to move out. So I think it only makes sense, in fairness, to grant these tenants the same rights and protections as tenants that sign these rental agreements before that 120-day notice of sale goes out. The second issue that has come up that I think is worth the committee considering is how rent assignments work in tenants facing foreclosure. A rent assignment is usually a term in a deed of trust that allows the lender to start collecting income from the property, such as rent, as soon as the borrower is in foreclosure, is in default on their payments. So oftentimes, tenants will be contacted by a lender directly who they really have no knowledge of and some random third party to say, you know, under this term in our lease, in my contract with your landlord, you're supposed to start paying me rent. And the tenant often is getting the same demands from the landlord, keep paying me rent. They're confused. They don't know what to do. And our law currently does not speak to the issue of rent assignments at all, and tenants are left to kind of figure out who to pay at the risk of being evicted if they get it wrong. And we did have a call recently to our office on this very issue where the tenant just got a lender, an agent for the lender came and knocked on their door and said, "Hey, I'm you know, related to the lender that your landlord owes money to, and under our contract, you should start paying your rent to me directly." The tenant wanted to do the right thing, wanted to make sure they're paying rent to the right party, so they called the landlord to say, "I got this contact, what should I do?" And landlord said, "No, I'm dealing with it, I'm working it out, you know, keep paying me." And both parties were fairly aggressive in trying to get this money from the tenant. And I don't think we want to put tenants in this position where they're trying to sort out whether this is a valid rent assignment provision in a deed of trust and figure out, you know, who to pay. Another issue that often comes up with rent assignments is that if there is a legitimate rent assignment provision in a deed of trust and a landlord agrees, yes, tenant, pay your rent to the lender, oftentimes the house will fall into disrepair. You know, requests for repairs or sometimes even utility services will go disconnected because there's no one really directly responding to these repair requests. Under our current law, if there is a rent assignment and money is going to the lender, you know, the responsibilities of a landlord in terms of keeping the property in good shape and habitable do not flow to the lender as well with the money. And as you might expect, sometimes landlords, when they no longer are having any income, come in from the property and foreclosure is really looming around the corner. They'll just wash their hands of the property and won't keep it in good shape. And tenants are left following their side of the agreement, you know, paying rent, but they're not having safe and secure housing being provided by the lender or the landlord at that time.
Christina, can I ask at this point, and we'll take questions after as well, what's the best solution to that rent assignment issue?
You know, one thing I've thought about, and I think we outlined some options in our memo, but I think some kind of notice that goes out to a tenant that basically would explain to them from the lender maybe that this is the provision in this contract with your landlord, you need to pay rent to this address. And then if tenant does follow that notice, they would be held harmless from any possible eviction action by the landlord or even setting up some kind of escrow account that they pay rent into and let, you know, tenants don't want to have to figure out who's right here. They just want to pay their rent. And so maybe the landlord and the lender can figure it out amongst themselves from an escrow account.
Thank you.
Those are some possible ideas. And, you know, so one thing I think that might be worthy of the committee considering down the road is directly addressing this rent assignment issue head on in any future changes to Senate Bill 952. The last issue we've just been beginning to see, and I don't know, you know, we're just kind of watching it and taking note of it, is that sometimes there's some fairly misleading notices going out to tenants that are, you know, I don't know what the motivation of the folks are that are sending these notices, but sometimes leading tenants to maybe believe that they actually only have 10 days to move out as if it was an owner-occupied property and they don't have the full rights of a tenant to, you know, 60, 30, or 90 days, depending on what statute you're looking at and what tenancy they might have. And then the other issue we've seen is that a lot of times foreclosing entities will hire real estate agents to basically door knock a whole building and try to get tenants to enter into cash for keys offers before any notices, formal notices about the tenants' timelines to move out are sent. I believe there was a fairly big complex out in Pendleton, if I don't have that mistaken, where, you know, tenants were being offered a few hundred dollars to move out with a matter of weeks or 2 weeks notice and waiving any rights. And it's only when a tenant says, no, I don't want to sign this agreement, that a formal and proper notice would be sent out to the tenant, advising them that they actually have much longer to move out. But a lot of folks are feeling threatened that, oh, I have 10 days to move out. I need to sign this and get out now. So these are some of the issues we've seen so far and some of those pressing issues we've seen facing tenants living in homes threatened with foreclosure. Our memo outlines some other issues that I think are worthy of your consideration. We look forward to this ongoing discussion about these issues. I'm happy to take any questions, and thanks again for the opportunity to talk today.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Committee, questions? Senator Rosenbaum, any questions? Senator Burdick?
I guess I'll ask a question.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as a practical matter, are lenders sending out, it looks like under the federal law, the minimum notice you can have now is 90 days. Are lenders that are embarking on a foreclosure routinely sending those notices to tenants, whether they intend to evict them or not?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, I think that the practice is varied at this point. We're still learning about what's happening on the ground, and I think one of the big challenges is that they're relatively recent laws, and a lot of folks don't fully understand or may not be fully aware of them yet. So one of the things that we're working on is trying to get education out about what the responsibilities are. But as Ms. Dirks mentioned, we have seen examples of notices that have not included the appropriate information. And so we're, you know, will be concerned about that if that continues to be the case. As we mentioned earlier, the request that we have submitted is for the technical fixes that I think are clear and easy to identify and accomplish. The other issues I think we continue to believe are very important, and we're hopeful that we can find a way to resolve them down the line. They do seem complicated, and we're still learning about them. So. I don't. It's a roundabout way of answering your question to say that I don't know exactly what's happening.
If I may, sure. Chair Bonamici and Senator Rosenbaum, the notices I've seen have indeed been really, really mixed. Somewhat of a form notice I've seen basically will be sent to the tenant and say, you know, we've purchased this home at foreclosure. We're representing the agency that is now, you know, the owner of this home. If you have a tenancy, please send in your rental agreement or proof of your tenancy within so many days so we can assess what rights you might have. Because, like John said, under the federal law, there is no notice provision that has to go, that goes out that says, tenants, if you live there with a tenancy, send us your documentation within a certain period of time, like our state law provides. So a lot of times these foreclosing entities will be asking for that information once they take possession of the home, and then sorting out what rights people are entitled to at that time.
So just to follow up, maybe I'm not tracking this. The federal law puts the obligation on the purchaser of the foreclosed home?
It's actually
not
silent.
The lending
it's silent.
Institution.
It doesn't really say.
It says the successor in interest after the foreclosure, which could be the lender or could be the purchaser if there's a purchaser.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a problem with a one-page bill.
I was going to add that earlier this week I talked to Pat Wade, who's a lawyer in Eugene, whose firm does a lot of representation of lenders, and who represented the Oregon State Bar, sort of started our discussions. He didn't necessarily want to end up where we ended up, but somebody that we worked with, and asked him what problems he was seeing, and his answers partly were it's too early yet to see, but we're concerned about confusion over what exactly the federal law means. For example, are my clients landlords? And then secondly, the confusion between the two laws and trying to be clear about that. But I believe that his clients are giving the 90-day notice. They don't want to be, he's represented that his clients don't want to be landlords. So they want to terminate the relationship as quickly as they can.
Well, and just a final comment. I mean, it would seem like a practice that would probably start, just because if you haven't decided what you're going to do with that house, but you want to protect yourself in the event that you decide to sell it again, you just give the notice. It doesn't mean you have to follow up with an eviction. I would assume you'd just do that.
Well, that's a good point. So now you see another problem. Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, in the law you passed, we actually provide that the lender or the purchaser at the foreclosure sale has to act within 30 days by giving one of the termination notices. The loophole you just identified was so we give a termination notice, that doesn't mean you terminate it. You don't have to actually get them out. But we've said, and you've said, and that's in your bill, that they have to do one of those notices within 30 days because we were worried last session about a lender who might simply sit on the property and not do anything. And then you've got a tenant in the unit who doesn't know who the landlord is and nobody responsible for repairs or utilities or anything like that. And we were reading those sorts of stories from the East. I haven't seen it personally in Oregon.
And we were also concerned about the situation, which, John, you addressed in my earlier question, of a tenant getting a notice that the house was in foreclosure, scrambling around, trying to come up with security deposits, finding another place to live, and then coming back and saying, oh, well, no, we worked it out. You don't really have to move. So we were trying to avoid that problem as well. Senator Gerard, do you have a question?
Actually, I got a couple. The first is, and I have a little bit of familiarity with this now, which I wish I didn't, but the difference between foreclosures and bankruptcies. And are bankruptcies directly affected by these bills or not? Because they're two separate entities in essence as far as, I mean, you would think a foreclosure would be part of a bankruptcy, but not necessarily.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Gerard, I think I'm not the right person to answer your question in general. I don't know if John or Christina know more. They are two separate procedures. Filing a bankruptcy can toll the process of a foreclosure, but other than that, it's my understanding that there are two distinct and separate proceedings.
The bills that we're talking about only affect foreclosures and not bankruptcies.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And so the bill that you passed only amended Chapter 86, 755, with foreclosures. So I don't know about bankruptcies.
Interesting. You might want to look at that. The second thing is, it seems to me that timing of where it is in the process is kind of paramount as well, because what the lady was describing, who do I pay my bill, you know, just the sheer notice that, look, the building's under foreclosure, the owner missed two payments, he became current on the payments, it's not a problem, that the solution would be quite a bit different than the one that's in a full-blown takeover by the banks, or they're selling the interest in the building on the steps of whatever county. So it seems like that whatever we do would have to be somewhat time-restrictive as to where it is in the process. Just does that sound logical?
Madam Chair, sounds right. Yes, it does. And I think that's partly why we're saying that we're not here asking you to do anything other than those three small fixed things. We don't think we know enough. We need to learn more about that issue, the bankruptcy issue that you just identified, the issue that Senator Rosenbaum identified. So, yes, we agree that that's something we ought to pay attention to.
Any other questions? I wanted to ask about outreach efforts, and I'm going to ask the same question of the panel, too, on this issue. What are the outreach efforts that you know of in the community to let people know about these rights?
Chair Bonamici, the efforts that I know about so far are, various. We have a brochure that we put together that actually Ms. Dirks drafted that's very significant and sort of is a FAQ, answers to common questions that might come up if you're a tenant in this circumstance. And that's on our website, and we also provide that in all of the legal aid offices across the and Oregon Law Center offices across the state. In addition, we have a one-page summary that we've sent out to many different community action organizations and community service organizations. And they have agreed graciously to try to provide that to their clients, and we're trying to get that out in the community as well. And I've also had conversations with members of the industry, and they have generously offered to provide that information that we provide them. So we're open to ideas and suggestions. Housing authorities, thank you as well, have also gotten the information and have agreed to share that with their members and their landlords participating. So,
and do you know, have there been efforts at the federal level on that federal bill to inform communities about that, or are people just expected to know?
Chair Bonamici, I think they've been trying to do a lot of PSAs and newspaper articles, and there's been some publicity, but I'm not aware of more formal efforts. I don't know if my other panelists.
I do believe that letters were sent to various courthouses, to presiding judges, letting them know of this new statute, that if it comes up in an eviction proceeding, they should know that there's these certain notices that might need to be given to tenants that could be relevant to the eviction action.
And I believe also, and we're appreciative of the efforts by the State Court Administrator Office, State Court Administrator's Office sent a letter out to presiding judges in Oregon, which we appreciate. So,
any other questions? Thank you very much for your
testimony.
And our next panel is Chris Ambrose and Paul Cosgrove.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. And just a couple of quick preliminary comments. As you have realized, and you may recall from last session, these issues appear straightforward at first and end up having lots of complications as we get down into the nitty-gritty. And that's one of the concerns. I think we all work pretty diligently to try to pass a bill that worked in Senate Bill 952, and before the end of the session we realized we needed to amend it and use 3004 to do that, and now we know we need to do some other things, and that just, I think, reflects the complexity and the multitude of parties who are involved in rights that need to be taken into account in a system that needs to work. A second preliminary comment is that when we change these statutes, there are a whole lot of folks in the community, in lending institutions, in law firms, in foreclosure services, both inside and outside the state, in title companies, who have to get familiar in order to implement them correctly. And that process is still ongoing. I am a member of a listserv, Chris probably is as well, of the real estate section of the bar, the debt credit section of the bar, the consumer law section of the bar, and at least once a week I see a request that comes across from one of those members of those listservs saying, I don't understand this, I think there's a problem with this, we need to figure it out. So the process of educating the world, both tenants and other folks involved in this process, is ongoing. We have recently, I talked to Sybil yesterday and saw her handout that you're reviewing last night or yesterday afternoon. And with respect to the issues that are being called technical corrections that Mr. Van Leiningham mentioned, which are on that numbered list, number 7, 8, and 9, we agree that those are good things to address in February. They are technical corrections. They'd be helpful. They would improve the process, eliminate some confusion, and make some necessary corrections. With respect to many of the other issues, those are substantive issues that need a lot more discussion, and we're committed to continuing to talk to folks about those, but at least on first blush, they may raise more problems than they have answers, and so I think we're not sure that those are in fact that we have an idea of how to address those issues and what that idea might be. Although I think that we are pretty certain that a couple of the suggestions, for example, eliminating assignments of rent clauses in mortgages would be horrendously difficult for the lending community. It's one of the major pieces of collateral in commercial loans, so and in loans of multifamily residences as well. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and turn it over to my cohort here, Mr. Ambrose.
Thank Chair you. Bonamici, members of the committee, Chris Ambrose here on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association and with Ambrose Law Group. We do represent primarily lenders and brokers, so we're coming at it certainly from that perspective. The one thing that that Mr. Cosgrove mentioned that certainly is true, listservs can be a really humbling experience, and that's that's what we're certainly experiencing right now. A lot of what we are hearing is anecdotal, not necessarily something that is an issue or a problem across the board. It may be one person, it may be two people. But at this point in time, we simply don't know. The laws are too recent to be able to come up with a consensus on what's working and really what isn't working. Even the notice provisions for loan modifications and that whole process that we went through appears to be working. But again, it's a little bit too new. The one thing that the lenders are looking for more than anything else is predictability. And the thing that I look at, and when I speak with people about these issues, is who essentially has the most control over solving a problem. For example, when a tenant is entering into a lease in the middle of a foreclosure, that tenant certainly has some control, albeit perhaps with limited information. The landlord doesn't have control over, or excuse me, the lender does not have control over that process. They know what the existence of the leases were at the time of providing the loan. They've to some extent monitored the property, although certainly not always, and they are looking for some predictability on what the worst case scenario is in case they have to go through the process and ultimately get the property back. So the lenders are looking at it from that perspective, and dealing with the tenants certainly is something that they're interested in doing. That's why the lenders and the industry went through that process during the last session and trying to come up with some type of compromise solution so that the tenants are not left out to dry. One of the things that the other panelists did mention was the concept of perhaps modifying to some extent what's going to happen during that 120-day foreclosure period for tenants that may enter into that process. It certainly is worth discussing, but there always seems to be this unknown out there that we find out from lenders is going to be a problem once we start raising the issue with them. Having said all that, there also is the concept that fraud is fraud. There are going to be bad borrowers, bad lenders, or bad borrowers, bad tenants, bad landlords out there, and if they're willing to take a security deposit from a tenant under fraudulent representations, that certainly is something that the lenders are concerned about. But when all is said and done, that's where you get back to the whole concept of who actually has control over the situation, who's in the best position to be able to make a determination on whether they should provide a security deposit, what the status of the property is, and so on. In many cases, in fact, most cases, the lender is not in that position to be able to make that determination. When all is said and done, and certainly happy to answer any questions, the issues that were raised by the other panelists, and I certainly would like to thank them as well. They did reach out to the industry. We have had communications and discussions about what might work, As Mr. Cosgrove mentioned, 7, 8, and 9 on that list are certainly ones that the OMLA and most lenders, I believe, would be agreeable to. They're correcting certain areas. Continuing the dialogue is the best approach, we believe, at this point with respect to all of the other issues that are essentially on the table. There is also one item that it's actually in 3004, but I'll throw it out there because it is something that I think is worth addressing, and this comes down to the comment about the confusing and troubled lawyers. And we have an issue with respect to 3004.
That would come back to haunt.
There's an issue with 3004 where if you look at it in a certain way, it arguably allows a deficiency judgment after a non-judicial foreclosure with respect to commercial or investment property, which I am fairly confident in saying was never the intent of 3004. It's simply a matter of drafting and placing some comments in various other places, and so I'm throwing that out there at this point and would certainly be happy to follow up on it. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair. I kind of have a question about value. And the question I have is, it would seem to me like if you were undergoing a foreclosure and you had a big rental facility, say 20-person facility, that it would be in the interest of the banks and the lenders to keep as many people in there because the value of the facility is directly related to the percent of occupancy and the number and the dollars that are coming in so that they can show a positive or negative type of positive cash flow. So the question I have is basically, I really think that we need to protect the investments of the renters. And so how can we do that and still not cross paths with the lending institution? And to take that a step further, and dealing with bankruptcy, I'm telling you, anybody that's ever dealt with bankruptcy, all the contractual law goes out the window. So it seems to me like the banks would want something to protect the occupants of the building during a bankruptcy as well, so that that the value of that commodity stays as high as possible.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, your first question is a very apt one. In a lot of foreclosures of multifamily residential property, meaning an apartment complex or even a triplex or duplex, the lenders I represent don't serve the occupants with any notice of the foreclosure because they don't intend to affect their interest. And under state law, if you don't serve someone with a notice of foreclosure, their interest is not affected. In other words, their intent is to continue the process, continue the occupancy. That is often different when you're talking about a single-family home, but at least in the multifamily, it's very common to have that situation. So I think you're quite correct. Foreclosure causes concern and problems for everyone, including the lenders and the tenants. There is the basic thing that makes lenders' situation more difficult is, as Chris mentioned, we don't have, as lenders, the authority to do anything with that property until the sale occurs. Last session, there was a bill that was discussed, a good-hearted bill about abandoned animals, and as originally drafted, Senator Bonamici may recall, it would have required lenders to take care of and abandoned animals. And as I talked to the advocates, I said, I have no problem with you trying to be deputized so you can go in and get abandoned animals, but we have no legal right to enter the house until the foreclosure is done. We don't want them abandoned there either, but we have no legal rights until the process is done. That also affects what happens to the tenants during foreclosure, where landlords are obviously financially stressed in some way, and they may stop paying utilities, and they may stop doing repairs, which hurts the collateral, hurts the tenants, hurts the lender. But again, we don't have the authority to do anything about that until the sale occurs. So that's a problem, but you're correct. In the multifamily context in particular, most lenders in almost all cases want to keep tenants there, want to have the property maintained, and want to have the tenants there at the end of the process because they're not interested in occupying all those apartments. They're interested in continuing to rent them. With respect to bankruptcy, when I was a junior lawyer in my law firm, one of my clients said, but that's not fair, and the senior partner sitting next to me said, but that's bankruptcy. And that's very much the case. All parties who are not the debtor in bankruptcy get harmed by bankruptcies. Debtors also have their own issues, obviously. That's why they're in bankruptcy. There's very little that under, and bankruptcy is a creature of federal law, and we have very little ability as a state to modify what happens in a bankruptcy case. Some, but very little effect. We can pass state laws that say bankrupt debtors need to do certain things during the pendency of the bankruptcy. We can, in individual cases, approach trustees, bankruptcy trustees, and or bankruptcy courts to try to get property preserved and tenants taken care of during the bankruptcy. But it's very difficult to do in any meaningful, ongoing way. It's a difficult process.
Can I just follow?
Sure.
Paul, why can't they just, once a bankruptcy was noticed or a foreclosure was noticed, the idea of paying that into a separate account and then letting the courts figure out where the money goes, does that cause people grief or is that, I mean, does that cause the lending institutions grief?
Chair Bonamici and Senator, are you talking about paying rents into a separate account?
Right. I mean, paying...
It requires the consent of the landlord, who is the person being foreclosed, or the permission of the court, which is otherwise direct, bankruptcy court, which has otherwise directed that money, generally speaking, to a trustee. So it takes two to tango, and we're only one part of the dance. So absent a court order in a bankruptcy court on a case-by-case basis, there's no way to accomplish your result. And absent a landlord agreeing or us going to state court to get a state court judge to establish a receivership where a receiver has the legal authority to be the manager and landlord, we can't also do that. There would be not a problem whatsoever in general in your solution. It's just not easy to accomplish.
Okay, one final question. You talked about multifamily apartment buildings looking like that they come under a different, the premise being different than it would be like for a single house. Can we design the bill around, zoning in some way? So like if it's a triplex or more or a fourplex or something like that, it comes under a different set of criteria than it would like a single occupancy. I can understand, a single home that's been rented out, somebody who wants to buy it for their own home, that's going to, that's going to be different in the bank's perspective on that. And you're not probably going to sell it to somebody that's going to want to rent it out. You're going to sell it to somebody that's going to want the home. That, to me, would be a lot different than if you bought, an apartment complex.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, right now in Oregon law, in foreclosures, we do make a distinction. We define residential as being single family or 1-4 units. So we do make a distinction at least to that extent. Whether that's the right cut, 1-4 units or 1-2 units or 1-3 units, I leave to you. It's a policy decision. But there are differences in what you can do as a lender and what your rights are in those two cases.
The federal law does recognize the difference, too. If the purchaser will occupy the property as a primary residence, then 90 days rather than the entire fixed term. Is that in our state law, too?
Parallel provision.
So we did make a distinction if the purchaser intends to occupy it as a primary residence. Chris, did you have something to add?
Chair Bonamici and Senator Girard, I would simply add to that. With respect to control of the property, there's this mistaken assumption out there that the lender has a lot more control during this foreclosure process than they really do. They don't have control over the rents unless they actually do get a receiver appointed, which can be an incredibly expensive process. But Senator Girard, in respect to your comment, or with respect to your comment about the multifamily homes, larger units, they most lenders do look at it as having no desire to evict those tenants. And so anecdotally, again, I'm not sure that, at least I personally have not heard anything. Nobody's brought to my attention the issues with the larger complexes. I'm sure there's some that exist or problems that exist out there. But by and large, the issues that we're seeing are those single-family residential properties, 1 to 4 units, where you've got some private money investor out there who owns a piece of property or is a lender, and it definitely creates rather unique issues. But other than that, most cases they're not interested in evicting the larger complex tenants.
Madam Chair, if I may just make one final comment. And one of the things that lenders don't know is they don't know at any given time who occupies the property, who has the right to occupy the property, or most importantly, for all of these provisions that talk about if you have a week-to-week or a month-to-month or a term, those agreements we don't have copies of. So in some cases, we're put in a position not knowing who's there and under what terms or provisions they're there. So that's one of the practical problems of implementing this, is we have to have everybody working together to find that out.
Right, understood.
Thank you.
Any questions further?
Madam Chair, and this really wasn't part of your testimony, Paul, but one of the outline points in the previous testimony was the lack of any enforcement mechanism or remedies in either the federal or the state law. So they laid out a range of options that they thought of. Do you have any thoughts about what you think would be the best direction for us to look as we look forward, maybe not in February, but to 2011?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I just saw it last night, and I've only really skimmed it, and my client hasn't seen it yet. And frankly, it will admit to you that I'm not terribly familiar with the federal, except that I know that there are a lot of questions in the federal law because it's only a page long. So I would rather defer that for further discussion and amongst the parties, and maybe we'll be able to bring back to you an answer to that question come 2011, or before 2011, but for consideration by you in 2011.
Thank you. And I would very much like to have discussions about how to deal with the rent assignment issue. I understand, Paul, your concern about, if we got rid of rent assignments, that would be a significant issue. But it seems like it's in everyone's interest to figure out a clear direction to the tenant. Where do I send my rent? So let's work on that.
Chair Bonamici, yes, and we've had that discussion and have raised that as an issue. It certainly is in the lender's interest as well. When they send out a notice and send a copy of the recorded assignment of rents, it does cause consternation among the tenants, certainly, and that's understandable. Perhaps some kind of presumption in favor of or a presumption that they're not going to be evicted if they provide payment to either the landlord or to the lender may be appropriate. If the lender sees that it's appropriate enough to pursue it, they can always seek a receiver and then present that order to the tenant.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Both to both panels, and we'll continue to work on that issue. And it is correct, I do have a bill request into Legislative Council on this issue, and anybody who has thoughts or concerns about this, please contact me. And we will move on now to the second issue on the agenda, and this is titled Responsibility for Nonpayment of Homeowner Association Dues, and we have several people here on panel one, and I don't know, panel one, if you want to split up into two different groups. There are five of you. Do you want to all come up together, or Rich and Karna, do you want to?
We'll go first, and then the homeowners will go.
Terrific. Okay, so Karna Gustafson and Rich Vial are going to be first, and then so we'll have a panel one, part one, and then panel one, part two, and then a panel two.
Senator Bonamici, Madam Chair, is it possible to stand over there, or am I, because of the microphone?
No, you need to be here.
Okay.
But you could bring something over that.
Well, I think I'll have to put this in front.
You could put.
It's the only problem is the cameras can't see you if we put.
I had intended to be able to stand up and like a teacher and kind of go through this.
No, this isn't a courtroom, but.
I've never been in a courtroom, thank goodness, but Rich has.
Yeah, we were both kind of affected by that presumption.
Well, we'll do our best to look at what you brought, so. Thank
you. Are you ready, Chair Bonamici?
Yes, we are ready. Thank you.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, my name is Rich Vial, and together with Karna, both of whom are attorneys practicing in the area of homeowner association law, we want to take a few minutes and discuss with you the problems that foreclosures are actually creating for homeowners associations. So this is very timely, coming on the heels of the discussion that you just heard. We represent a lot of folks. No one has been able to count them all yet, but we estimate that in Oregon alone, it's well over 2 million of Oregon's residents that are now affected in some way by a homeowners association. Either they live in one or own property in a homeowners association. We don't know how many that homeowners associations are represented. We know that nationwide there are over 250,000 homeowners associations, which have somewhere arriving at 100 million people living in them. And Oregon has at least its share of those, if not a little bit more than its share, because of the way our Western developers have developed property. Oregon in particular, because of its strict land use laws, has virtually no subdivisions developed anymore that don't have a homeowners association. Most jurisdictions are requiring that a homeowners association be created, if nothing more than to take care of the stormwater runoff, or to take care of perhaps the interior streets or signage or something like that. So it is almost unheard of today, even in more rural communities, to find our typical single-family dwelling in a subdivision that does not have a homeowners association. Now, the thing to remember, I think, is that homeowners associations have only been around since the 60s. Anywhere in the U.S. If you look at the concepts of private ownership or town governments are 1776, basically, or even before. The lending institutions have been around since the very beginning in our country. But homeowners associations didn't arrive until the 1960s. So we have very little history, if you look at it in relative terms, with homeowners associations versus other kinds of law. And that affects a lot about what happens. Now, it's important to remember that every homeowners association has several responsibilities. And I'm going to go through a number of the things that they have to take care of in a minute. But before I do, I want to make it clear that in Oregon we have different types of homeowners associations. And when Karna testifies, it will be evident why that's important, because they're treated differently today. And part of what we would like to ask you to consider is whether it's appropriate that they're treated differently. Homeowner associations may be like is shown in the graphic that I've put in front of you now. I hope you can see that. That graphic shows a four-unit building, in essence, sharing a roof. Even though the units are of different color, they share siding. They share a variety of things. This graphic was made for a litigation matter, actually, so I don't want to confuse you with some of the titling. But if you look at the pictures themselves, you'll see that, for example, in this case, if it leaks, the leak may not affect just one unit, or it may not affect the unit under which the leak occurred. You see where you've got a leak on a roof, that unit isn't affected at all. The next door unit is. Now, that picture right there, I'm going to ask rhetorically, is it a condo or is it a planned community? Very few people would know what the answer to that question is. And the answer is, we have no idea. Because from the picture, you cannot tell whether it's a planned community or a condominium. Let me describe those two types of ownership for just a moment. A condominium describes the property on a plat. You have a copy of a plat there. Don't worry about looking at it right now. But a plat, where the interior airspace, bounded by the interior surfaces of the walls, floor, and ceiling, is what you buy. You buy a picture on a survey that's recorded with the county, and that's what you control. That's it. Now, in the 60s, when the concept of condominiums first came along, a lot of folks bought them, and by the late 70s, when we had our last recessionary period, people were saying, boy, I want to own it. So developers came up with the next concept, which is essentially a zero lot line subdivision where the product is still attached, just like you see the picture, but you own the exterior of the building. However, recognizing that if it might leak on your neighbor's roof and affect your unit wasn't a good idea, a declaration was recorded, similar to a condominium declaration, but now it's a planned community declaration, which essentially describes the rights of each owner and the responsibilities of the homeowners association in exactly the same way that a condominium declaration does. So now we've got two types of ownership. The survey looks different because on the survey, you may be owned to the center of the earth and up to the sky, not just your airspace, but there's no difference whatsoever in how those two products are being maintained, or there is no difference in the relationship that the homeowners association has to the individual. Unfortunately, as you'll hear Karna describe in a moment, our two laws treat those two homeowners associations differently in terms of their ability to collect assessments. Currently, the priorities for the collection of assessments are here. If you've got to collect your assessments for a homeowners association, county taxes are going to come before any of those assessments, and the lender is going to come before any of those assessments. The third priority is homeowner association assessments. When you listen to some of our owners testify in a few moments, I think you'll begin to appreciate why that is a problem. Now, what are these assessments used for? Let's consider that for just a moment. Assessments are obviously used to administer the property. Any community needs to be administered. Now, I will tell you that one of the things, having done this for 30 years, and our firm has thousands of homeowner associations, those that are financially healthy are happy. In other words, peace is a direct corollary to the ability to pay your bills. And when you can't even afford the expenses of administration, for example, let's take insurance. If you can't afford to purchase errors and omissions insurance for your board of directors, who wants to serve if they're going to be personally liable? And any member of a board is obviously liable for problems that are caused by board action. Everybody could make mistakes. But without liability insurance, you can't get board members to serve. What about issues like legal fees to collect unpaid assessments? If we did not have an IRS, would fewer people pay taxes? That's a rhetorical question. But of course, the same issue applies to these mini municipalities or these small governmental entities, just like it does to larger governmental entities. In fact, I would submit to you that because these are smaller, personal, local, and very, very accessible matters of municipal operation, they should be the ones that are given the greatest deference in their ability to manage themselves effectively. They have the least likelihood to be burdened by the negative effects of bureaucracy, and yet they are treated as the complete redheaded stepsister in our current legal system. What other expenses? Expenses of maintenance, repair, replacement. Obviously, in this situation, if you're the unit that's getting the leaks, you don't want your next-door neighbor to be able to say, well, it's not leaking in my unit, I'm not paying my assessments. Or you don't want a situation where, because that unit is in foreclosure and no one is paying assessments, you've got to pay an extra amount. How much extra? Maybe $5,000. In the case that this graphic was created for, that went up to our Supreme Court, the special assessment necessary for each unit was $50,000 to take care of the problems. And every time one unit didn't pay, that $50,000 burden got allocated to other units. It's simply unfair, and so the advocacy that we're trying to bring to you today is give this homeowner association, all of these homeowners associations, everyone who acts this way, to try and administer in a peaceful and reasonable fashion their homeowners association the opportunity to collect those assessments. If we don't do that, we run the risk that not only will the individual homeowner's value be affected, but so will the lenders. We believe that the lenders are increasingly beginning to appreciate the fact that a payment of assessments by all owners is critical not only to protect individual owner property, but lender security as well. Now, finally, I just want to make a couple of comments about the idea that we have horrible, overbearing boards of directors who treat folks terrible. All you got to do is look on the internet and you'll find the sites who say, let's do away with homeowners associations. They're bad, they run amok, these boards don't have enough controls over them, etc. We have two statutes, the Oregon Condominium Act and the Oregon Planned Community Act. Both of those statutes, with very few exceptions, like unfortunately the lien rights and the ability to collect, operate exactly the same way. They put controls on these boards. These boards do have to hold open meetings. These boards do have to run their meetings in accordance with Robert's Rules of Order. They do have to provide information and communication to their owners, and they are required by law to make sure that they operate without breach of fiduciary duty or conflict. Now, do they all do that? No. Ever since we began to organize ourselves into towns, there has always been an abuse of power somewhere, and that's unavoidable. But homeowner associations have just as much regulation over their leadership, in fact, in many situations more than do our counties and cities. We need to give these folks the opportunity to conduct their business, and the only way we can do that is to allow them to have the money necessary to provide the services that they're required to provide. Many times, they are required to provide their services not by any choice of their own, but the developer parent who set that up wrote into the declaration, these will be the things this association does. And then he sells the units, turns it over, and these owners are left to their own devices. They don't have a choice. If they don't maintain, the owner whose unit is leaking is going to sue them just as quickly as someone else may sue them because they think they're charging too much. Thank you very much, and we'll turn it over to Karna.
Rich, I want to ask a question just to clarify. Sure. The priority that you put there, first county taxes, second lender, third homeowners association assessments, is that true for both condos and planned communities?
Yes, it is.
Okay, yes. Thank you.
I will give you an example during my testimony as to how condos can be treated differently.
Thank you. All right. And are there questions now of Mr. Vile, or should we? Senator Gerard.
My curiosity, $50,000 you were talking about was due from each unit. Was that mostly water damage, or what was
that? Yeah. Senator Bonamici, Senator Gerard, the case that this went to the Supreme Court on was a leak case, as many are, and the $50,000 was the cost to not only take the siding off, but to repair the dry-rotted sheathing, the dry-rotted structural members, in many cases repaired sheetrock. It was bad. And unfortunately, because this one was a planned community, not a condo, which there are some nuances in terms of the way the law attempts to treat them, the insurance lawyers, the defense lawyers, essentially said, no, you can't have access to the developer to try and get remuneration on that. Fortunately, the court did not buy that argument, but we had to go to the Supreme Court to get that done.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This, I think, might be a question for yourself. So could you just outline just really briefly what's the topic of this portion of the agenda? It probably was in some email that I didn't read. And
it's on the agenda.
So it's non-payment of HOA dues?
Homeowners
the
dues.
Problem?
Right. The problem
in
is
foreclosures,
yes.
Or
when
in general?
When there's a foreclosure in, and I'm going to let the experts here explain it, but when there is a foreclosure, as in a situation, it could be a non-foreclosure situation, somebody just isn't paying, then the rest of the people in the Homeowners Association have an increased burden of paying those fees. And so this group is invited. In fact, there was a bill in the last session that we heard testimony about on the same issue to continue to explain, because they continue to have concerns about how this is affecting the other residents of the community. Senator Gerard.
Well, that put in another question in my head, and that is...
Sorry.
<That's okay. laughs> Sorry, put a question in my
no.
head.
No.
But
no,
something in there.
You don't have to apologize for asking.
No, the question is, who? I mean, the money that the assessment, doesn't that go into a separate pool owned by the homeowners association, and not that doesn't go to the any other entity? So excellent. What we're talking about is only strictly the money that is owed to the homeowners association, not the money that was in the pool.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, that's absolutely true. In fact, homeowner associations are essentially required by law and by tax implication to assess only what they need to pay their bills. And so they assess it, they create a budget, they assess it, they put it into a fund, and from that fund they pay their vendors, they pay their maintenance people, et cetera.
Well, just a follow-up then.
Sure.
Okay, since that's a separate entity, why is the fact that there's a foreclosure impact that entity?
Because it gives the entity...
I should ask you. Okay.
Yeah, essentially that's what Congress
was talking
about. That's okay. I'm just giving you the entry points here.
Maybe we should let Carney give her testimony, and then you'll have a new set of questions. How's that?
Yeah, I'm sure I will.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, for inviting us here today to talk about this ongoing problem with foreclosures and homeowners associations and non-payment of homeowner association dues. I actually supervise the three paralegals and two assistants in our office to do collection of homeowner association assessments, and right now we have, as you can imagine, several thousand delinquent owners at the current given time. Various different stages, one month non-payment to bankruptcy and foreclosure situations. So we're dealing with all of it right now. What I'm here to explain, Rich did a great job overviewing the differences between the Oregon Condominium Act and the Planned Community Act, what a homeowner association is, what common expenses are, that there is a budget that these boards of directors adopt and divide amongst all the homeowners. And those expenses are fundamental to the running of the homeowner association. If they didn't have the assessment income, they wouldn't be able to pay their bills.
Karna, can I stop you for
sure.
just a minute? We have formalities. Can you please just state your name for the record?
Oh, I'm
Thank
sorry.
You.
Karna Gustafson, partner with the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein.
Thank you.
Apologize, Senator. So these common expenses are divided amongst everyone in the community, and this budget is set by a board of directors. Under the Condominium Act and the Planned Community Act, there is a lien that arises once the non-payment situation occurs. So they miss one payment on their assessments, the lien of the association automatically arises. That change to the statute occurred in 2003. The legislature adopted a automatic lien when the declaration is recorded for the creation of the project, which again arises once the non-payment situation occurs. This homeowner association lien does have priority over second mortgages, But as Rich pointed out, it does not have priority over county taxes or a first mortgage. So those types of things have, I guess, priority in payment when the sale occurs over the homeowner association lien. So therefore, county taxes and a first mortgage can wipe out or extinguish the interest of the association in the foreclosure. What we're asking in proposed legislation and what we asked for last session and will continue to ask for is a priority situation for 6 months worth of assessments to be paid or that are required that the lien survive the foreclosure sale for 6 months worth of past assessments. I have a visual. Can everybody see that? Everybody see that on the committee? In your materials, I've just gone through the introduction, and in your materials is a fact pattern scenario, so I'm going to try to explain what we're trying to accomplish with a proposed legislation. In January 2005, Jane Doe buys a home in a homeowner association. 1 year later, she stops paying her assessments in January 2006. 6 months later, she stops making her mortgage payments. That's in July of 2006. Another 6 months goes by, and the lender starts the foreclosure process. Now, lenders can take, I've identified on my chart there, a six-month foreclosure process. That's a fairly typical length of time it takes from the for the lender once they start foreclosure to complete the foreclosure. But we've seen them take as long as 9 to 12 months to complete a foreclosure process. Then the foreclosure sale happens in July of 2007. At the foreclosure sale, a number of things can happen. The lender can bid in the amount of their judgment, in which case they're not required to provide cash. We could have a second mortgage holder come in to purchase the property, or we could have a third party purchase at a foreclosure sale. Any of those situations could arise at the foreclosure sale. From January 06 to July of 07, you can see there's a year and a half worth of non-payment assessments, or 18 months. Assuming this particular homeowner association has a $100 a month assessment, that's 18 months worth of non-payment, or $1,800. What we're asking for in the proposed legislation is for the pink area to be paid by the foreclosure sale purchaser, which is 6 months worth of back assessments. Now, obviously, if the foreclosed upon borrower doesn't owe 6 months worth of assessments, that amount would reduce by whatever the amount actually is, but up to 6 months worth of assessments. That amount does not have to be paid until you can see the final line on the chart, which is at resale. So foreclosure sale purchaser will resell the property at some date in the future, and at that point, that six-month lien that arose at the time of the foreclosure sale would not have to be paid until the time of the resale by the foreclosure sale purchaser. So that they would pay the pink amount plus any of the orange plus sign. So that could be 2 months later, 3 months later, 6 months later when the property is resold, because that was the orange portion is when they own the property. The pink portion is for the prior amount prior to foreclosure. This would be just like a real estate tax lien. A real estate tax lien would be treated very similar to the way we're asking this to be paid. A real estate tax lien is not, a check is not written at the foreclosure house steps. The real estate tax lien is not paid until the property is resold. So it's very similar. So there would not be a check that would need to be written at the foreclosure house steps. It would not need to be paid until the resale of the property. Now, why is this important from a consumer protection position? Let me change my diagram here. Let's assume the same association, 10 homes, they could be condominiums or planned community lots. $100 per month or $1,200 per year. The association budget would then be $12,000 per year. Again, all of this information is in your materials. If we have three owners, with represented by the three pink X's, were foreclosed upon, that amount unpaid for 18 months would be $5,400. That $5,400 would need to be redistributed amongst the seven remaining owners in the approximate amount of $770 apiece. Well, you can imagine what that would do to potential foreclosures and other people going into default. The two additional orange X's represent the two additional owners who would now not be able to pay their assessments or their mortgage, which would cause at least half of this particular project to be now in foreclosure. It would cause, if they couldn't pay that $5,400, that amount, they would have to decrease maintenance on the buildings, decrease landscaping. We've had situations, I know one that we represent, that was unable to pay their water bill because water and sewer charges are provided as part of these assessments, these common expenses. And they had such a huge water bill, they weren't going to be able to pay the water bill for this particular association. So roofing gets deferred, gutters aren't cleaned, leaks aren't fixed, roads aren't fixed as part of this problem. As you can imagine, decrease in property values then happens when landscaping isn't fixed, maintenance isn't done, which could cause additional owners not to be able to refinance or then sell their homes, possibly causing increases in foreclosures and defaults to the point where we have a non-functioning homeowner association. This is happening. This is happening especially in areas where there is not a lot of money, a little bit low end. We've also seen high profile examples in Nevada and Florida where you actually have associations in bankruptcy. And we have several, and I believe Rich does too, where the project is failing. In our situation where we're asking for 6 months of priority for the foreclosure sale purchaser, this would eliminate $1,800 from that $5,400. Again, reducing the amount to be paid by the other seven owners down to approximately $500. Again, it's not much, but at least it may cause additional repairs to be made in the project and to allow certain things like insurance and water bills to be paid. It may not clean the gutters, but it will allow additional money to be paid to the association. I have one additional slide here.
There you go.
Rich talked a little bit about how condominiums are treated differently than planned communities. This is an example on how a condominium could be treated differently, even though on both sides of the street you have townhouse-looking project. One's a condominium and one's a planned community. Jane Doe buys her unit in January of 2005. Jane Doe stops paying her assessments in January of 2006. Jane Doe stops paying her mortgage in July of 2006. Under the condominium law, the association can send a notice to lender at any time after the non-payment occurs. In my example, the notice to lender is sent August of 2006. Under the condominium law, the lender has 90 days to start its foreclosure, not complete it. All they do need to do is send a trustee's notice of sale, start the process moving, of starting their foreclosure process. If they fail to start their foreclosure process within those 90 days after the notice to lender, the association's lien would then have priority over the first mortgage holder. In Rich's example, would not have priority over the county taxes, but would have priority over the first mortgage holder. Now, why is this important? This provides an incentive for lenders not to sit on properties they don't want to foreclose. We've had numerous situations where the property, they don't believe the property value is there, or they're too busy and they're not interested in starting the foreclosure process. This is unfair to these other seven owners who would like the foreclosure sale to happen so they can get somebody in there who has now can afford to pay the $100 a month assessments. If they delay it longer than the 18 months, we've seen 2 and 3 years it take for the lender to start the foreclosure process, in which case we have situations where we have the unpaid assessments going on for a continuous lengthy period of time. This encourages the lender to foreclose in a timely fashion and, again, start the process. We're not asking for it to be completed within the 90 days, just start the foreclosure process. The overall benefits to the proposed legislation, again, we're asking the Planned Community Act to mirror the Condominium Act legislation, and we're also adding to both statutes, or asking to be added to both statutes, the 6-month priority for the foreclosure sale purchaser to have to pay when they resell the property. The overall benefits include building maintenance being performed, keeping water running, insurance paid, keeping property values stable, preventing additional delinquencies and foreclosures, keeping a fully functioning association, and avoidance, hopefully, of special assessments. Now, how does this benefit the lenders in these projects? Obviously, it can prevent future foreclosures of the people who are, the amounts are being transferred to them. It keeps the properties up and maintained well, so when the lender needs to resell the property, they can resell it at a value that would be commensurate with their lien against the property. In summary, I'd like to say, you know, we're all in this together. You know, we're not asking for a lot here. We're asking for some help, some protection against for these other seven owners in these particular homeowner associations. We have observed, Rich and I's offices have both observed local lenders who are willing to step up at the plate, and we have received payoffs of the 6 months' worth of assessments from a lot of the local lenders. We've seen local lenders willing to be good stewards of their properties that they lend upon. It's really the problems that we're having are in the big conglomerate banks and trusts where these mortgages are sold on secondary mortgage markets who are, you can't even find anybody to contact. There's a address in the trust deed and that's it. That's where we send these notices to lenders in condominium projects. We'd like the same opportunity to notify the lenders of the default in planned communities. We need to work together to rebuild our Oregon communities so that we all have healthy homeowners associations for all of these 2 million people to live. If there are any questions?
I have Senator Bonamici, excuse me, I have two comments just to add on real quickly.
Okay, and if you'll say your name again, please.
This is Rich Vile with Vile Fotheringham. The first question that always gets asked when we ask for any kind of a priority relative to lenders, is this going to affect lenders' ability to lend? Are lenders going to stop lending, et cetera, et cetera? Probably the best measure of that is Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, et cetera. 13 states in the U.S. plus the District of Columbia already have the kind of law that we're talking about. None of them have recorded any decline in availability of money to purchase homeowner association properties. So we do not believe that the proposal as we've put it together would affect lenders. Secondly, you have to ask yourself, how come the Condo Act has this and the Planned Community Act doesn't, this current law? Well, here's the history on that. When we went through this last downturn, it was 1981, and we began looking at this. By 83, we asked the legislature to help us solve a problem with lenders who would not pursue their foreclosures. At the time, planned communities were single-family houses sitting in a subdivision with maybe a gate or a sign. The Planned Community Act hadn't yet been discovered by developers to where they could essentially develop condos under the Planned Community Act. And so at the time, the legislature did not deem it necessary, but since then we've had a very different development pattern that now really creates the need to align those two statutes. Thank you.
This is Karna Gustafson again. The Planned Community Act was not created until 1982.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Girard.
I need to ask question 101. Going back to the 12 units or 10 units that you gave in your diagram, what power do you have out of the gate to collect the homeowner's fee other than just the lien? Is there anything other than the lien that you have in order to make sure that people pay the $100?
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, yes, we have the right to sue individual owners in a separate state lawsuit for a money judgment and further to garnish their wages and bank accounts. However, this is limited when they are not working and they're in foreclosure and they're not paying their mortgage payment. They are most likely, at least in our cases, unemployed and do not have the ability to pay this. And that can be further eliminated by, as you pointed out earlier, bankruptcy. The bankruptcy will wipe out the association's ability to personally collect from the owner. And that's the situation in most of these foreclosures. There's a lot of bankruptcies.
That answered one of the questions. The second one would be, it seems like a lot of the problems is the way the contract is initially written. As far as the homeowners association, the way that it's set up and not giving the homeowners association enough power to enforce the homeowner paying the fee. Do you see that as a potential another way? I'm just looking at different avenues. I'm not saying that's going to correct existing problems, but it seems to me like the homeowners association is kind of the weak dog here. Okay, go ahead.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, I would love to see escrows set up to pay homeowner association assessments just like the real estate taxes. If we can convince somebody to have these escrow accounts just like county taxes are set up to pay these homeowner association assessments, I think that would be huge and go a long way to making sure that these are paid. I don't think I can convince the Congress to set some sort of law up like that, but I think we have about as much teeth, except for what we're asking for here, to go against the owner personally. There's nothing we can do about bankruptcy. Foreclosures do happen. I think that the statute pretty much controls how we go after individual homeowners for collections, not the individual declaration or bylaw contracts.
Okay. Senator Bonamici, Senator Girard, one more thing on that. Homeowner associations have exactly the same tools as the county does when it goes out to collect its taxes. In fact, it has even more tools because of this personal lawsuit that it can bring. However, the problem is that because we're below the lenders, when we get into a market like this and the foreclosures take place, there's nothing left. We don't have any security for our position. Now, if the lenders were below the homeowner association, then the lenders would put the escrow requirement on loans for the homeowners association fees just like they put on for county taxes now. But as long as the lenders are ahead of the homeowners association, we don't have that leverage like the county tax folks do.
Okay. One final. Sure. And this goes back to question 101 because sometimes I feel I'm lacking something here, but I understand the bankruptcy problem, and I understand how this might apply to a bankruptcy. Now, foreclosure is markedly different. Now, why is your debt erased in a foreclosure since the money owed is on the entity of the building itself or on the unit that would be purchased? So it would seem like a purchaser then would be purchasing something that has a debt on it of $1,600 or $1,000 or whatever. And so that's where I'm not tracking probably.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, we would love if that was the case. Unfortunately, the way the statute is written, it gives the lenders the ability to foreclose out the entire amount upon a foreclosure. So right now, the way the law is, it wipes out the entire amount that's owing. So we're not treated like county taxes, real estate taxes at all, which would survive a foreclosure. We do not survive a foreclosure.
Any other questions? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in these typical HOA agreements, are the amount of the assessment on an individual owner automatically goes up if somebody stops paying their dues without having to vote or amend the agreement?
Senator Rosenbaum, Madam Chair, The budgets of these associations are a zero-line item amount. Yes, they would have to be redistributed. Very few associations have additional money unless it's an extremely large association, say like Sun River or Forest Heights or Murray Hill, that has the ability to set an additional little bit of money aside for bad debt. What will have to happen is the next budget cycle to pay their bills, they'll have to redistribute that amount that was unpaid to everybody else.
So follow up, Madam Chair. So what you're saying is basically I'd be paying a certain amount for whatever the period of the agreement is, and then the next year, whatever.
Or a mid-year.
They have to meet annually or something.
Or mid-year. Budgets can be changed mid-year.
And then retroactively raise everybody else's assessment?
That's correct.
So there's no, if I'm in an HOA, I have no guarantee that I'm going to continue to pay what I started paying?
Senator Rosenbaum, that's correct.
Time.
And we're going to have three homeowners here testify to that effect in
just a minute. Final question, sure, Madam Chair. There's just one piece of your proposed solution that I don't understand, and maybe you could just go over it again. So it sounds like what you're proposing is if I buy one of these units at a foreclosure sale, then this 6 months in arrears amount, I don't have to pay it. It's only when I sell it again that the next person I sell it to has to pay it?
No, you can negotiate in your, again, sorry, Karna Gustafson, Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, you can negotiate that in your sales agreement. It would be a lien just like a tax lien that would have to be paid at closing. So that six-month lien for prior to the foreclosure sale, as well as any unpaid assessments after the foreclosure sale, would then have to be paid on the resale. So if you purchased at a foreclosure sale and you sold 3 months later, you would owe the $600 plus the additional 3 months for when you owned it. So $900 would have to be paid at closing. You can negotiate in your purchase and sale agreement whether you would be paying that or the purchaser would be paying that. It would be a lien. Just like real estate taxes. So just like real estate taxes, it would follow along, and on your closing statement, the $900 would appear and would have to be paid as a lien to give clear title.
That's using the $100 a month example.
Right, uh-huh. Using the $100
a month. So if I buy the unit at a foreclosure sale and I just keep it and I don't sell it again, then I'm the one who owes this six-month
right
amount.
Correct.
But if I sell it,
it would have to be paid.
So
by somebody.
So somebody, either I pay it when I buy it initially or the next person
right.
I sell it to pays it if we work that out in our agreement.
That would be correct.
Okay. Thanks. Senator Girard, you look puzzled.
Yeah, well, hey, I'm still going there. Okay, I mean, you have the right to put a lien. Okay, and now I've bought quite a bit of property, and so when I go to the title company to buy the property, it shows what the lien is and what the lien amount is, and that goes with the property. So that goes back to her question. It seems to me like if you have a bona fide lien, then what you're saying is foreclosure law supersedes the lien and that your lien is eliminated. Is that kind of where I'm at then?
Chair Bonamici, Senator John, if you look at my hierarchy, at the time the problem occurs, there's three liens on the property.
Right.
There's a county tax lien, which gets their money first.
Right.
There's the lender, which gets all the rest of the money in almost every case.
Sure.
If there were extra money left over, yes, we would get it. And back in the heyday of property going up faster, of course, there weren't foreclosures, but if people didn't pay us, the homeowner association, we would foreclose on those liens and we would get paid. The problem is now, if the lender is ahead of us, and all the money left goes to the lender, there's nothing left on our lien.
Okay, so things would have to be upside down pretty markedly.
And they are in virtually every case. That's why we're in the situation we're in.
Could you briefly explain the Washington? I see on your chart here of the states that have a limited priority lien. What is, because that's been around since 1991, how does the Washington law work?
Do you want me to do it?
Well, we both practice in Washington. Richville, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. Washington works essentially like the six-month priority proposal that we're proposing. Let me put it this way. In a practical sense, to answer Senator Rosenbaum's earlier question, what happens under Washington's law and what would probably happen under our law if the proposal were to go through is that at the foreclosure sale, 6 months of assessment get turned over to the Homeowners Association. People just don't want to mess with how are we going to take care of this downstream, and so it gets turned over. That's how Washington's works in 99.9% of the cases that we handle in Washington. And we've got, in our office right now, we've probably got 5,000 Washington homeowner assessment collection files, and we see this issue come up every day.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, very often in Washington you get a call from the title company before a resale actually occurs if Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac was a successful purchaser at the foreclosure sale. We'll get a call from the realtor saying, okay, how much do we owe? We'll write a check now. They don't have to. Again, it's a lien just like what we're asking for here. They could pay it when they do resale, but in their cases, they've actually been just asking us for payment right there and for a payoff. But they're not required to. They just happen to be doing it, which we appreciate.
Thank you. Other questions? All right, we're going to hear part two of panel one.
And I'd like to introduce them, if I may.
That's fine. You'll have to stay at the microphone and let them then take your spot.
Okay.
We're going to hear from some homeowners. Do you want to stay there, Karna?
Yeah, I'll stay here.
Terrific.
Just,
okay,
for a
just
second.
Pull up another chair, or if you just
no,
want to
stay
there for the introduction.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll be fine.
Welcome.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, I'd like to introduce three board members of three different homeowners associations here that would like to share their experiences with the situation that we've been talking about here in non-payment of homeowner association assessments. On my far left is Leland Jacoy with Fairview Terrace Homeowner Association, which is an attached townhouse project in a planned community, which is similar to what you see in Rich's diagram. In the center, we have Mitch Carpenter with Jackson Hill Homeowners Association, which is a detached single-family home planned community. And to my immediate left is John Shambro with the Tannisbrook Condominium Association. It's a condominium association, a very large one of, I believe, over 300 correct condominium units. Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome. Have you decided who's going first? You flip the coin. And you've been watching. I know we have a formality. If you could just say your name first for the record. You don't need to say your address or anything.
No, I'll go first then.
Okay.
My name is John Shambro. I'm the chairman of the Tannisbrook Condominium Association. And we are, if you have material in front of you there, we are a 340-unit condominium in Beaverton, just off of 185th and Cornell Road. We sit on 53 acres, and it's a kind of community that will never be built again because it was farmland when it was developed. We have green belts, we have lots of trees, and we have lots of amenities that we're now trying to pay for, but it's a it is a unique community in the area. We're also, in a way, a mini city because at the time of development, the agreement was that Tualatin Valley Water brings the water up, and we have all the water piping and everything else. We have all the sewer lines. We have all of the roadways that we maintain on behalf of our 340 owners. We have 63, those 340 units sit in 63 buildings that we also maintain for everybody. So in many real purposes, we are a small municipality. And, of course, we get into all the compliance and enforcement things of trying to make people be good neighbors and good owners as condominium associations will. We have seen, as you have heard here, a substantial increase in our past due accounts because owners are struggling as they get laid off and lose their jobs or find that they have reduced incomes. And we've seen our past dues increase from $43,000 at the end of 2007 till the end of November of this year. We're at $153,000. This has a direct effect on our bottom line. Last year, in 2008, we wrote off $57,000 worth of a direct hit on our bottom line. In order to have the cash to pay our dues, the other owners that were paying had to pay that much more. They had to make up that $57,000 difference. And this year, so far, we've written off $52,000 through the end of... Well, October, I guess, through the end of October this year. I've written November down there. I was thinking of this month, but it's really last month. You can scratch those Novembers and put in Octobers. So we're on pace to exceed the write-offs for this year in uncollectible dues that we have. And everybody else has to pay in. We can't pay bills with accounts receivable. We can only pay bills with cash. And so here we are trying to run our little mini city of 340 units, and we're trying to maintain our roads and maintain our sewers and maintain our water lines and maintain our buildings, and it's expensive. It is just simply expensive to do this and do it right and have a quality community. I've also mentioned that while we don't have excellent demographic information about our owners, if we go through our list and put our heads together, we find that 44% of our owners are single women. We have many retired people in our community. They like the amenities that we have. We have one of the few places in the metropolitan area now where you can actually buy a single-level condominium unit and have an attached garage. Everything gets built up now because of the cost of land, but when we were developed, we do have single-level units, and this is very attractive to people who are retiring and want to find some place to spend their golden years. So we have a lot of people on fixed incomes. We're facing now, we have an ongoing thing with our finance committee on budget increases. Our finance committee is saying we can't afford to have a budget increase. We're saying, but we have all this money we can't collect. The ability of a priority lien to claw back some of this money upon closure as foreclosure to get 6 months would be a material assistance if we could do this. What do we have now? We have 9 units in foreclosure, but we're seeing that number increase practically on a monthly basis. And these things do turn over. I don't know how many foreclosures if we took those are the ones that are currently we have foreclosure notices on. We've had a number this year where we've had foreclosure notices that have ended up, going through the full process, and I don't have a total on that, but it is an ongoing situation with us. So from our standpoint, the ability to claw back 6 months' worth of dues on things that would be in foreclosure would be of material assistance to our owners and of material assistance to being able to maintain our property as it needs to be maintained, because we do operate as a mini municipality. That's all.
Thank you for your testimony. I know the area well because it's in my Senate district.
Oh.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? No? And who's going next?
Yeah, I'll go. Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and committee members. My name is Mitch Carpenter, and I'm the president of the Jackson Hills Neighborhood Association in Happy Valley. It is a single-family subdivision that contains 210 lots, 210 owners. We've been plagued by the same concerns that John here has, and the fact that the foreclosure rates are so high and owners not paying their dues have left us a shortfall this year of about $42,000. That really is not correct, because our actual shortfall was $120,000 carried over from the year before. And we ended up writing off around $65,000 in dues that were not collected. We're a little unique in the sense that our association has reached the maximum limit it can charge its owners. We have a cap of $500 per year per owner. And if we are to exceed that cap, we need 75% of the owners to agree upon that. And quite frankly, that's not going to happen. We can't get seven owners to agree to do that, let alone 75%. So what that leaves us is a shortfall. We are having a meeting tonight, and the meeting will be on our budget. We have about $13,000 left in our account, and the main topic tonight will be how do we finish out the year. We do carry reserve accounts, and those reserve accounts are meant to take care of items that that you may have to roads, lighting, play equipment, and other things that may need to be replaced over a 10-year period, and we account for that, and we have money set aside for that. As of last year, as well as this year, we are going to have to borrow from that account to make it through the year. We, our neighborhood consists of about 6 acres of common area. A lot of that is wetlands, walking trails, and a playground for the kids that live in the neighborhood. And when we do our budget, we account for those maintenance items on a regular basis. What hits us hard is the things that we don't see. One example is that I've left you in a memo there, is our wetlands are fairly new. The subdivision has only been around for 5 years, and we are required to report to the city as well as the state on the growth of the wetlands, how well they're doing, how well the plants are doing. And right now, a lot of that is failing as a result of the developer-builder. And so, therefore, we are required to bring this wetlands, which is about 2 acres. We are required right now to bring that up to standards for the state of Oregon, which right now we're guessing that that's going to run us around $30,000. Where that money's going to come from, we don't know. Just to give you an idea of foreclosures in our neighborhood, Happy Valley has been on the radar screen. I know that people have seen it on the news. We have suffered some of the largest decrease in values, some as much as 30% in value. That in our neighborhood, we have received, in the last 18 months, we have received 35 or more notices of default and foreclosures that have gone into a foreclosure situation. In piggybacking what some other folks have said in here, when they go into foreclosure, prior to them going into foreclosure, they are not paying their association dues. That's probably one of the things on their list they're not going to pay. They're going to provide food and clothing and electricity to their family, and association can just stand in line with everyone else. But the lenders this year, foreclosure may take 120 days, but foreclosures right now are taking a year. I've got one family in our neighborhood that has been in a foreclosure situation, notice of default filed, that's been there for 14 months, and they're still in the home. So they didn't pay their association dues last year, and they didn't pay them this year. They'll go into foreclosure. They owe more on the home than what the home is worth. When it does go into foreclosure, the lender will get their money, and the association will be left out in the cold. And I feel the 6 months repayment from the foreclosure proceedings is very very minor compared to the overall picture. And Senator Rosenbaum, you mentioned something about the association dues when they're not paid being spread amongst the other owners. And in a way they are, but we're in a unique situation. I can't spread those dues among the other owners. I'm at my maximum right now. I cannot just vote and have the association dues go up to $600 or $700 a year. I'm capped out right now. So we have to make do with what we have and find a way to make it through next year. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Burdick, did you have a question?
Yes, I do. What happens when people don't pay their dues and there's no foreclosure? I mean, what remedies do you have?
We, Madam Chairman, Senator Burdick, committee members. We have a collection resolution in place that at a period of time, and I can't tell you right off the top of my head, I believe it's about 90 days or so. If the dues are not paid within the 90 days, then we set them into a collection situation where notices are being sent to them, and collection, we're trying to collect the dues is evident by the attorneys that we have with our association.
But follow up, please. But there's no lien authority associated with that.
Well, yes, I believe the collection resolution does allow us to lien the property, and we do lien the property once it gets to a certain point. One of the things, though, that we have to be careful as association in the current financial situation that everyone is in is it costs the association to file a lien, and we are just not going to file a lien against you if we don't think we can collect. So if you've filed for bankruptcy or the collection attorney has talked to you and you are unemployed, you have no money, we're going to think long and hard about filing a lien, because whether or not that lien is going to be collectible.
Thank you. Senator Rudd?
I've been following up on this line of questioning for a while, but it was brought up before that you have the right to sue and to drag them into court and get a judgment. Now, if you have a judgment, does that change the order that we see down here versus a lien?
Madam Chair.
The attorney's coming up to answer the question.
Thank you.
Rest assured.
Thank you. I'll refer that question.
Yes?
Rich Vile, Vile Fotheringham. Chair Bonamici, Senator Gerard. No, it does not. The judgment may affect it in a bankruptcy if there was actually any money to be distributed. But even then, it doesn't change the priority that I had laid out earlier. The county is still going to get their money first. The lender is going to get their money next, and only if there's money left over.
Let me do one more follow-up. If there is a lien, say, from a builder or something as far as somebody, they did improvements to it and they failed to pay, that's a common lien. Where does that rate on your little chart?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Gerard, construction liens are a kind of a different animal, and they are driven solely by priority of when they were when they were placed on the property. And of course, there's the 90-day or 120-day, I think it's 120-day time period that you have within which to file the lien after the construction's completed, et cetera. That, properly done, comes ahead of everybody except the county taxes. So that the construction lien may come ahead of even the lender in many cases.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, we have one more person to hear from on this panel.
Thank you, Senator. Chairman Bonamici and members of the committee. My name is Leland Jakeway. I'm the chairman of Fairview Terrace Homeowner Association. We are a 196 townhome in the planning community. The foreclosure and the state of the economy has hit our association extremely hard. Our accounts receivable balance as of September 30th is $94,011.63. We have 3 foreclosed homes, 8 pending foreclosures, 3 pending foreclosures halted by bankruptcy, and then 3 other homeowners filing for bankruptcy as well. And some of our foreclosures are taking up to a year and a half to go into foreclosure. The homeowner is still living in the homes, and our home association is still responsible for maintaining the landscaping, paying their water bill, because we are responsible for the water and sewer for every home, as well as putting funds into the reserve account, so when the siding comes time to be replaced, they have a roof leak or roofing needs to be replaced, we're obligated to pay those as well. Our assessments keep going up year after year after year, mainly for the fact that we don't have the funds coming in that we keep budgeting for, anticipating that homeowners would be paying their dues and that the foreclosures would not be happening. So at this point, we have people who can't pay their homeowner association dues, and ultimately their homes are getting foreclosed upon because they can't pay their mortgages either. So the 6 months paid to the association would be greatly helpful, just for the fact that at least it would help us to maintain the homes and pay at least the water and sewer and the maintenance on the homes as well. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. question, Senator Gerard.
This goes back to the developer and the systems development fees that they paid. I'm kind of curious. It seems to me like the cities have punted a little bit of their authority here, in that almost every city I know has systems development fees for streets. Every community I know has systems development fees for water. Every community I know has systems development fees for sewer, and almost everyone has systems development fees for parks. However, it seems like we've taken the associations down a road now that the cities have punted their obligation just as much as everybody else has, and that's contributing largely to this problem.
Senator Bonamici, Rich Vile, Vile Fotheringham, Chair Bonamici, Senator John. Yep. and it's worse than that.
Okay.
The reason it's worse than that is because the municipality, city or county, has this absolute priority on its ability to collect assessments. So we're all going to pay our road fees and water fees, et cetera, no matter what, to the city or county, but yet we have much more control over how those are actually administered, in the case of Tannisbourne, for example, at the local level, and yet we can't get them collected. And so this is a problem. Homeowner associations have long argued, give us a break for all those services that we provide that we're also paying taxes for you to provide. In other words, adjust the homeowner association members' taxes. Hasn't ever gone anywhere. That's a completely different subject, however, than I think we're talking about today. But I appreciate the question. Gave me a chance to kind of get it off my chest.
Madam Chairperson.
Yes, go ahead.
Committee members, one of the other things that we're stuck with as an association, when you are a new association, typically the builder-developer sets an association due far below what is adequate to really pay your charges or fill your budget. So when you look at a new subdivision such as Jackson Hills, when we acquired the HOA from the builder developer, we immediately doubled our HOA fees just to pay a realistic budget. And so we've been left with that, and you're also left or plagued with problems from maybe a poor developer or a bad builder, and that affects your budget as well. So a new association, I think, is hit a lot harder than maybe an established one that's had time to go through a budget process year in and year out. So
the other panelists might not agree with that. Thank you very much for your testimony. We are going to hear now from panel two. I have Chris Ambrose, Paul Cosgrove, and Jim Marquis, and I did get a note from Mr. Cosgrove that he needed to leave, and I don't see Mr. Marquis in the room. Mm-hmm. Are you out in the hallway? Or,
Mr. Marquis had to make another appearance as well.
Okay, so are you...
Yes, I'm it today.
You're it. All right, welcome back, Mr. Ambrose.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I certainly won't pretend to be able to cover for Mr. Cosgrove and Mr. Marquis, but I'll certainly do my best and would be happy to answer any questions. As I guess a general overall concept.
Did you identify?
I'm yourself? Sorry, Christopher Ambrose of Ambrose Law Group and the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. As a general concept, especially in these bad economic times, everyone, and I mean everyone, has a story. And as part of the lien process and the foreclosure process in the state of Oregon, certain priorities have been set over an extended period of time based on essentially a philosophy of compromise and what is the best solution to protect people as best as possible. I can assure you that the spouse who does not receive the alimony and who provides a lien against the ex-spouse's property is going to have concerns about a super priority lien in favor of an HOA. I can assure you that the individual that files a lien for child support against the ex-spouse's residence is going to have a complaint about the super priority interest of an HOA. And on and on and on. The individual that provides a trust deed because they are loaning money to a friend or family with the expectation that they're going to get paid back in order to assist them in these hard economic times is going to have a complaint as well. Bottom line is that the HOAs are looking to have this go down that slippery slope that concerns lenders, and that is that it's not just the HOAs. It's the child support. It's the alimony. It's the landscaper that does a little bit of work. All those entities that are providing work on the property that are seeking to have construction liens against the property who are now becoming secondary citizens to the HOA. That's a great concern to the lenders, and if there's going to be a solution with respect to the HOAs, and our suggestion is to open it up and have an overall review of the entire lien process and then ultimately make some legislative decisions on, again, who is going to be entitled to priority and in what order without simply having the HOAs treated in a vacuum. We believe that's the only fair way for everybody to have this addressed. There also is the discussion about the $600 to $1,200 HOA assessments. That, as I think everybody who has testified thus far would agree, is not particularly the issue. It certainly would help, but there are lenders. We represent lenders. They want to keep the value of the property. It's been acknowledged that many of these lenders do go ahead and pay those liens, notwithstanding the fact that they're not obligated to do it, because it's in their best interest to do so. However, last week I received a $120,000 assessment on a property that's upside down. I can assure you that the lender that is already losing substantial sums of money on that property to begin with is going to have grave concerns about a $120,000 lien or assessment coming in front of it. So I won't belabor the issue. If the this committee is interested in an overall dialogue with respect to the liens in general, we would certainly be happy to have those discussions. There are certainly some components here that have merit. Perhaps limiting it to some extent, perhaps even a limitation on a dollar amount might make some sense, but simply having this treated in a vacuum we believe would be inappropriate. And again, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Girard.
The question I would have is I have a problem with somebody being above somebody else in the lien process. What if we just treated all the liens equally and say that an entity went from $100,000 down to $80,000, everybody takes a 20% hit? Would you have a problem with such a philosophy? Because I agree with you. I think if you're going to do this, you need to revisit the whole lien process.
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, honestly, I can't answer that. My expectation, as you might imagine, is that the lenders would have difficulty lending in that scenario. But as with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, I can't honestly say what kind of effect that would have. Perhaps junior lien holders and junior lenders, second position lenders, it might be more palatable. A first position lender, I believe, would gut reaction is that it would greatly hinder the lending market in the state. But I'd be going out on a limb to commit to that.
It's an intriguing question, Senator Girard, but it's pretty complex as well. And when you have things like local governments and child support and all of those things involved in the lien process, it would require quite a bit of work, but interesting proposal. Any other questions for Mr. Ambrose? Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, all of you, on this issue. And we have one more issue on the agenda for today, and that is an update on the Consumer Contract Work Group. There should be a handout in your pile there giving you an update. It's a two-sided handout, and it includes a list of people who have been involved in the work group. You may recall that in our September hearing, we heard about complaints concerning consumer contracts, particularly contracts that automatically renew without the consumer's knowledge or consent, and then the related issue of early termination fees. There have been a couple of work group meetings. The list of participants is on the front page of this work group summary. There's some people who weren't actually in the room but who were informed of the meeting and on the mailing list. So at the first meeting, we talked about the problem
basically the problem that was presented to the consumer protection meeting, and the group had a discussion and asked for information about the complaints and what other states are doing. And then in our second meeting, we reviewed other state statutes and current contract language and complaint data and discussed possible solutions. The concept that was submitted to legislative council for the committee bill is as outlined on the back page, and it's right now just a general outline, and there's some explanation there underneath that there won't be an automatic renewal of consumer contracts except as described below. A contract can renew automatically, but only then goes to a month-to-month contract, can renew for longer than a month-to-month only if the consumer consents at or near the time of renewal. This is designed to apply to consumer contracts, not to insurance or certificates of deposit. The consumer can expressly consent to renew for longer than a month if there's an affirmative consent. And that can be made online, especially if the transaction was conducted online. Must be clearly and conspicuously disclosed. The early termination fees are permitted only for the initial contract term, and they need to be prorated for the duration of the contract. And we looked at what the wireless companies are doing. We had, I think, practically every wireless company except Cricket, which is prepaid, around the table. And they are, to our understanding, all doing early prorating for early termination. So we actually saw them as a pretty good model of what consumers should expect. Violations considered an unlawful trade practice. And there's one more thing that I wanted to add that I just came up, got more information about today from the Department of Justice, and that's something called free to pay. And what's happening in these situations, and I have a great little email with some pictures here on Belly Bulge Be Gone. This is the an ad for the I think it's pronounced Acai berry juice.
Oh, yeah.
And what's happening in this type of model is that the seller will promote a free, what they call a free or a risk-free trial offer. And from everything in the text of the ad, it looks like the consumer is signing up for this risk-free trial. And what they enter their credit card information for shipping. That's what it looks like. Shipping. You are signing up for the free trial bottles, and you're putting your credit card information there for this free trial. Well, then what happens is that the company starts charging them monthly for their monthly supply of acai berry juice. So what I'd like to do is make sure that the bill addresses this kind of situation so that the consumer, if the consumer likes the acai berry juice and wants to sign up for a monthly supply, then the consumer can do that after the free trial period rather than automatically being put into this transaction. And it's sometimes called negative option. That the consumer does nothing and they're still committed to this purchase. So there is some tiny little fine print that discloses that if you return everything and unused product and in the time period and you want to cancel, then you have to send everything back and you lose your shipping and handling. But from what it looks like in the transaction, it looks like the consumer's paying for the free trial. So it's called free to pay because it automatically converts from what looks like free to monthly payments, which are sometimes difficult to get out of. So we don't have, obviously, anything back yet from Legislative Council. One more thing I wanted to point out as well is this concept is very similar to House Bill 2631 from the 2009 regular session, which was Representative Esquivel's bill with many co-sponsors in the House. I was the only senator. I don't know why, but I was the only senator. I thought this was a good bill, and it dealt with automatic renewal of contracts in the 2009 session. It didn't go past a first hearing, and so this similar concept coming up for our committee bill. I plan to have one more work group meeting after we get the Legislative Council draft back, and if anyone is interested, you are all welcome. So any questions about the consumer contract? All right. Thank you very much. This concludes our Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today. Thank you. For